I'm on a tether. Let's see, how far is a tether going to go? Oh, geez, I'm far enough to step on. All right. Okay, far enough to step on. This is kind of weird. I feel like Janet Jackson or something. Okay. Purian interest. I can see it. I like it. My kind of crowd. So let me introduce myself again. My name's Kerry. I'm a recovering ski bum. It's really all you need to know about me. I grew up in Colorado. I'm very fortunate to grow up in Colorado. I actually went to Fort Collins High School, where they have the world's greatest mascot. It's an animal mascot. Probably you guys in the, it's not an AAHH type mascot. You guys all know Fort Collins High School mascot? The fight song is, "We're not great, but we're not bad. Go Lambkins, fighting." Yeah, you know, we're in Fort Collins High. I think it's affected my whole life. But somehow, you know, we're not secure enough to be a full-sized sheep. We have to be a baby lambkin. I guess that's because CSU stole the ram or something. I don't know, whatever. But so anyway, I graduated from Fort Collins High School, went to CU, graduated from the University of Colorado with a degree in marketing in the 70s. And I got a official certification, kind of like you guys have. It's a different kind of a certification, but my certification in 1973 was officially underskied, graduated. Probably skied every weekend or almost, but 1973 I was still certified as not having skied enough. So I moved straight to Aspen, Colorado. Yeah, dumb luck. Became a ski bum. Thus the I am a recovering ski bum. By the way, I'm recovering because every time I think I'm going to get over skiing, I take up, you know, snowboarding or telemarketing. So now I'm a snowboarder. Is that okay? Yeah. It's not really, but it's okay with me. But I moved to Aspen in the early 70s, and I was very fortunate, got lucky in the real estate world, built a little bit of a development business, bought some land in Telluride in Aspen, did some work in Glenwood Springs. You probably know what happened to Aspen. If you guys don't know that, if you're from Fargo, North Dakota, Aspen's this little tiny ski resort. Who's in Fargo? This is a test. Do you know where Aspen is? Okay, so I want to go in. But it's a nice little ski resort over on the other side of Colorado. But I got fortunate and first in the real estate business and then in the restaurant business and built a small chain of restaurants called Port La France. Built about 18 of them, and I'm going to use that as part of the foundation for tonight. Because here's sort of the cut into the chase. In fact, you know, we'll make this all common sense. You can go home and have a drink or go upstairs and have a drink. Bring me one. But what I did when I first started this business was probably like what you did when you started your businesses in the veterinary clinics or the animal hospital. You just put your head down and work your ass off. Anybody do that? Well, I need to get more work done, so I'm just going to work harder. Anybody do that? Yeah. You got to learn to do more with less. I need to grow my business, and I can't really afford to hire anybody, so I'm just going to work harder. Yeah, that's a good strategy, right? Well, that's what I did. I built a business, and by about 1987, I think we had about 9 or 10 operations, a couple of bakeries. We actually had 3 bakeries, a bakery in Mexico, or a bakery in San Antonio, Texas, a bakery here in Denver that's now called the Blue Point, a bakery in Aspen, and we had about 6 or 7 cafes on top of that. We were really, really good at the cafe business. Port La France, as you might know, is out at DIA, and it's doing pretty well. Thanks to a partnership that bought me out, I get to come and hang out with people like you and teach at the University of Denver now. But in 1987, we were unprofitable. You guys know about shareholder equity? Shareholder equity is that amount of money that's kind of left over at the end of the year on a cumulative basis that says this is how much money this company has made over its lifetime. We had a negative shareholder equity for the years we'd been in business at that time, about 7-8 years. It means we'd lost money on average. We'd lost accumulated money for the entire time we'd been in business. Anybody have? Don't raise your hand. We did a strategic planning session. We took a bunch of our... I took a couple of my partners, guys that had invested in the business in Aspen, actually some people from New York. I took a couple of our store managers, a district manager, had a vice president, got them together and went to Estes Park for 3 days. That was cool. That was fun. Anybody from Estes Park? Yeah. Yeah. You're from Estes Park too? Oh, you've been there. Okay. Fargo, Estes Park. You're a world traveler. My kind of world traveler. So we went to Estes Park, spent 3 days, and we came away with this little strategic plan. It was a little strategic plan because it was really focused. The thing that I'm going to cut to the chase here, the thing that we did that I recommend you do is learn to reduce and eliminate things that aren't really important. Cut out the stuff that's not driving value and cut out the stuff that's not building a big margin for your business. Just get rid of it. The thing that we did was we sold off our bakeries. We were lousy. I loved the bakery business. We kept bringing in these French chefs, paying them all kinds of money to make the world's greatest cheesecake and the best baguette. We kept bringing these people in from San Francisco, teaching us how to make bread. All we did was make, we were losing money. We were making bread, losing money. In the bakery business, all of our cafes were profitable. After 3 days of the strategic planning session, I'm going to get a little deeper into that. The one thing that really came out of this was the idea of focus. What are you great at? What do you really love to do? And what do your customers think of you? And if the customers think that you're in the cafe business and don't really care that you're in the bakery business, the smartest thing we did was sell it off. So here's what happened. Our shareholder equity went from a negative number, 87. We sold the whole business off in 1998 for a nice profit, very nice profit. We sold it off, I believe, because of that one strategic planning session, 3 days in Estes Park. So, by the way, do you think tonight's going to cover all 3 days? No. I hope what we do and what we do in the business world is give you some processes, give you some ideas, give you some tools that you can implement yourself, give you a few steps, literally, you know, step one, step two, step three. We'll give you a few of these ideas. Your job then is to go see if you can implement them. So back to my short story. Yeah, sorry, it's a long story, isn't it? But back to my long story. So did the bakery business, sold that off, and sold the whole restaurant business off in about 1998. By then, we'd built restaurants in Mexico, California. The two at DIA, please stop there. I don't own them anymore, but I love those guys. They set me free. 30 years in the restaurant business, that's full retirement, right? Yeah. That's where I lost my hair. Who said he was making fun of my haircut? It's not a bad haircut. No. Just outgrew my hair one day. You guys are in medicine. There's two things that the male does with testosterone, right? Yeah, never mind. One's grow hair. I better be quiet. I'm going to get in trouble, aren't I? What's that?
Did you go upstairs and have
it? No, I don't need it. I'm from Aspen. Rocky Mountain High. It's natural. So, 98, I moved down to Denver. I'd gotten married. My wife lived in Denver. She thought that Aspen lifestyle was kind of weird. She thought when we got married, we had to live together. So I moved down to Denver, and I was officially certified as being overskied and undereducated. I enrolled at the University of Denver, Daniels College of Business, got an executive MBA. And you know what happens if you're a bad student? What happens if you're a bad student, Cindy? They make you stay after school and write on the chalkboard. And that's what they did to me. So in 2000, I became a professor, and I started teaching leadership and marketing. In 2000, at the same time, I had a very close friend, a guy named Kyle Craig, who was the CEO at that time of Einstein's Bakery, Einstein's Bagels, those guys. And he said, "Kerry, you know, you've had this entrepreneurial experience, and, you know, God knows why you got lucky, but you seem to have, but you need big corporate experience, and I've got a buddy at this little coffee shop up in Seattle named Starbucks." So I got recruited by Starbucks. I told Constance this earlier, but I got to spend about a little over 3 years, and it's like getting a PhD in strategy. It's like getting a PhD working for Starbucks. Kind of an interesting company, by the way. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but part of my job is to help the stock price. Stock price went down when Howard Schultz said they lost their vision. So stock on the newest version of Fortune magazine, number two in the most admired companies in the world, Starbucks. Number one's GE. I have to knock them off next year. So now that you know that, please go out and buy some stock. Help my stock price go back up. Yeah, no. It's an admired company, and I'm going to talk a lot about Starbucks, but it's an admired company, and I think it's admired for a variety of different reasons. But one thing that I believe is true is that they really have their strategy in alignment. People from the very bottom, people in the barista level, the people who make your coffee, they're called partners. Nobody at Starbucks is called an employee. Do you know that? Employee is like a dirty word. They're not employees because they're partners. They're part of the decision-making process. They also, as soon as you start working for Starbucks, you work 20 hours a week or more, you get what's called bean stock. Yeah, coffee beans. You get bean stock. I had a kid, my next-door neighbor, we worked for Starbucks for 6 years. His bean stock paid for his college education. Not a bad deal. Of course, it was CU, so it was cheap, you know. So that's University of Colorado in Boulder, in case you're from Hawaii. I want to go home with you, man. So Starbucks is a company that figured out how to do strategy, and they figured out how to do it in alignment, and I'm going to share a few of those processes this evening. So maybe we should get into this. What do you think? Should we? Yeah, let's do this. So first we're going to get an overview of strategy. I was talking to Carl before we came in. Where's the word come from? Where's strategy come from? What's the word all about? Anybody know? By the way, can I ask questions, or do I just have to? Is this a speech or an interactive session? Hey, Carl.
Yeah.
Where's the word strategy come from? We invented it. Cool. All right.
It's from the Greek military.
It's from the Greek military. It's from warfare. Carl talked about strategy in terms of chess. Anybody play chess? It's about warfare. It's about capturing advantage. Are you guys in warfare? Are you in a competitive organization or a competitive practice that says we've got to compete and fight battles? We have to fight against our competition. You got to fight to keep costs down. You got to fight to drive revenues up. What strategy, I think, is all about is creating ideas and plans, executing on those plans eventually, that figure out how to make you more profitable. You guys want to make more money? I suspect, this is something that Constance told me when she was kind of coaching me, I suspect that many of you are in this business for the passion. Is that true? You're in it because we love animals, don't we? Yeah, you saw mine. Labradors. No sheep. But we love our animals, and my suspicion is a lot of you got into this practice because your passion for the business, the passion for the job you're doing, and that's a great thing. When your avocation and your vocation can come together, that's kind of the ideal world, isn't it? When your vocation and avocation, but if you want your avocation and vocation to come together, you kind of need to make it profitable to make it sustainable. Part of the word sustainability these days comes from the idea, I think, that you got to make a profit. In order to sustain your businesses, you got to keep going up. You got to keep building revenue. And by the way, from a strategic point of view, are other people in your neighborhood trying to steal your customers? Yeah, they are. They're trying to steal your business. They're trying to prove some sort of competitive advantage, some sort of idea that says our practices, our clinic is better than your clinic. Our customer intimacy is better than your customer intimacy, and we're going to steal your customers if you don't take great care of them. What we need to do, or what we need to think about, I think, from a sustainable business perspective, is figure out how to create plans, ideas, objectives, and tactics that drive a wedge that says, you know, our customers are going to love us. Do you guys do this? By the way, one more question. Yeah, lots more questions. How many people have done strategic planning in the past? This is old hat. Was it useful, Brian? Yeah? You do it every 6 months. A brand new strategic plan, or you just update it? Yeah. So will you share any parts of your strategy with us, or is that competitive advantage? Yeah. That's beautiful. You should come up here and help me teach this class, Brian. Yeah. That's kind of what you should do, I think. It's a process, and you do it every 6 months. What I would suggest is you do something like that, and whatever process it is, update it in a way that's meaningful to you. But let's get into this process. So strategies are the broad overall directions, priorities adopted by an organization. They're choices. They're trade-offs. I'm going to use a lot of stuff from people like Peter Drucker and Michael Porter and Michael Tracy, you know, these guys from Harvard. Actually, Drucker was from the Claremont University in California. But the idea is that a lot of these people have been thinking about how to grow business for a long time. A part of the process, I hope, too, is how to raise your margins. You need to figure out a way to increase your margin, because you're all going to be doing, all the practices are going to be doing something similar. But why will your customers pay you more? What would give your customers impetus to pay you just a little bit more for the same thing? By the way, is that what Starbucks does? How many people 15 years ago thought they'd pay $4 or $5 for a cup of coffee? You'd think that was crazy. But that's exactly what we want to do, is figure out how to build a margin, this what's called margin separation. We want to have margin separation that says that my margin is going to be better than the average margin in the industry. But there's sort of some pressures to get away from that, isn't there? There's pressures because you have great customers that you love dearly that walk in and say, I don't want to pay $500 for the arthroscopic surgery on my Labrador's knee. They don't want to pay that much money, so there's all these pressures, and you're nice people, so you're saying, okay, don't worry about it. Does that happen? Yeah. Strategic planning is a management tool, and like any other tool, it's used for one purpose, to help the organization do a better job. We believe that organizations do a better job when you have a conversation. When I was in my businesses, especially at Port-au-France, I always believed I was a half a brain looking for the other half. Yeah, I'm still kind of a half a brain. Don't agree with me too fast, Constance, here. But I'm kind of a half a brain looking for the other half, and you go into these meetings as a team. I love yours, Brian, where you're working as a team. Did you ever walk in with an idea that you thought was brilliant, but by the end of the day or the end of the meeting, it came out the other side? It was a completely different idea and so much better than your original idea. You ever do that? Yeah. Half a brain looking for the other, and that's part of what teaming and that's part of what strategic planning is meant to be about. Is strategic planning effective when you do it by yourself in a vacuum? Do you know leaders like that? You know bosses like that? Here's my plan. You execute. Okay, Cindy? You have one of those? No, don't tell me. I don't want. Yeah. We've all had people in our organizations. That's 20th century leadership. That's not 21st century leadership. I believe that 21st century leadership is the idea of 20th century leadership was, I'm the boss, I make the plan, I tell you what to do. That will not work in today's competitive environment, I don't think. What I believe works in today's competitive environment in the 21st century is, I may be the boss, but my best use of resources is hire people smarter than me, get them all into a room, and let's figure out how to make this business more profitable, make the organization do a better job, help the organization get better. Yeah. So, anybody have this problem? See, when you have an MBA, have you guys noticed there's a, I just read this statistic. In Shakespeare, in Shakespeare's time, there were 100,000 words in the English language. There are now 540,000 words in the English language. When you get an MBA, and probably when you're in science, you get to make words up, right? You guys make up good words. We make up, yeah. No strategies. Yeah, all right, you get it. Never mind, let's move on. So what is strategy? This is from Wikipedia. Long-term plan of action designed to achieve a particular goal. So we're going to figure out the action. We're going to figure out the goal. It's differentiated from tactics or immediate action because of the resources at hand. Strategy is meant to be long-term. Strategy, 1 year at least, 3 year, 5 year. A lot of people in the world think that strategies ought to be even longer, 20 years. You should not plan to have the shade from the tree that you plant, right? You should plant a tree that shades the next generation. That's part of what strategy is meant to be about, planting trees that help shade the next generation. You want to leave something to your kids and things like that? Yeah. Primarily from the military, yeah. Strategy is typically an idea that distinguishes a course of action by its hypothesis. Yeah. That a certain future position offers an advantage for acquiring some designated gain. Hypothesis. Yeah, you guys probably understand that word far better than I. But it means it's not a fact yet, right? Strategies are not meant to be factual yet. Strategies are part of a process that says, if we do the best that we can do, this is what we might obtain. I think it's a hypothesis about a very positive future action. The description of the idea is generally prepared in prescriptive documentation. This is a key. I was just working with a company in California over the last week. It's a company that's based here in Denver. It's called ECC, and they said I could. You guys ever heard of ECC? Environmental Chemical Corporation. I love this company. They're truly a great organization. They're helping clean up the environment. They're going around the world cleaning up nuclear waste, toxic dumps. They get all the fun in the super waste, the super fun sites. They're cleaning up Rocky Flats. They're cleaning up Rocky Mountain Arsenal. But they're incredible people. Working with them on a strategic planning session, and basically what's happened is you write things out like this in prescriptive documents. They handed this out to all the employees. They handed this out to all the employees, and basically it's this idea of we've created this strategy and we want to now get it in alignment with everybody in the organization, so they shared it. This is still kind of a draft version, but it's ideas about what the strategy ought to look like that everybody can see and everybody can share. And then it's got measurements, and it's got goals, and it's got timetables, and it's got things that say, we're going to do this mission review. Every time we make a decision, we look to see if our decision is in alignment with our strategy. It's called a mission review. And if it's in alignment, we go forward. If it's not alignment, we have to think about something else. The word derives, this is my friend Carl, it says, referred to a military commander during the age of Athenian democracy. Yeah. Here's what strategic planning is not. Strategic planning is not, that's a puppy, I love puppies. Strategic planning does not predict the future. It does not predict the future. It's a hypothesis for the future, right? There's a good distinction here, I hope. It's not a substitute for the judgment of leaders, but it's very much about helping people make good decisions. You can come on up here. Bring the puppy up front. Yeah. And by the way, now you have to, yeah. It's not always a smooth, predictable, or linear process. Do you guys live in a messy world? I do. I get up every morning thinking, I got a plan. Boy, does that plan get interrupted from time to time? Yes, it does. It's a messy world, and strategic planning and strategic the execution of the strategic plan is, by the way, going to be very messy. Can I touch the dog? Yeah. Stop, touch the dog. All right. It's not meant to be linear. What is also true of strategy? I think General Patton said this one. General Patton said, strategies are only good until the first bullet's fired. Is that what he said? You're shaking your head? No. Yeah. You know about Patton? No. I'm just going to pick on people randomly, okay? Strategies are only good until the first shot's fired. Does that make sense to you? Peter Drucker said this, you should be absolutely, absolutely committed to your strategy. Plan it carefully. Do the research. Get it right the first time. And be ready to change that strategy in the face of new market conditions. Does that make sense? Be ready to change your strategy in the face of new market conditions. So you've got the world's greatest technology. You've just invested all this money in some part of veterinary technology that I can't pronounce. And you're not very helpful, Bernadette, because I ask you how to pronounce that stuff. But you invest all this money and ideas and technology, and all of a sudden that technology, from what I understand from the veterinary medicine, you're almost doubling your science every 2 years. Is that what they said in Trends magazine?
I believe so.
Doubling. So whatever strategy you have today, you may think it's brilliant, but you may have to change it. And by the way, that's okay, because you're going to update it every 6 months or every year. You're going to look at new market conditions. You're going to do research. Do you guys do competitive research? Do you look at each other? Do you ever do industrial espionage? Send your dog into to the clinic next door. Would that be wrong? That'd be okay. I was in the restaurant business. You know what industrial espionage means to us? Let's go have a glass of wine at the neighbor's place. Yeah, let's go to San Francisco and have. I think that you ought to all be doing industrial espionage, but I also think you ought to be doing industrial espionage in sort of a completely different frame. A part of good strategy now is this thing called benchmarking, right? You know what benchmarking means, but looking what the best in the business is doing. I don't think that's true. Sorry. I think that is a very small piece of it. I think you ought to be benchmarking against the best in all industries. What is Kaiser Permanente doing for human practices? What is Toyota doing for manufacturing facilities? What is Starbucks doing for customer service? What's Nordstrom's doing to take care of their customers? I think you ought to be benchmarking as far outside your industry as you possibly can. I do a lot of consulting, and there's a company called First Data, great company, credit card processing company. They process billions of transactions a year, debit and credit card. They invented, God love these people, they invented the Starbucks gift card. Yeah, you know about this deal, this is a strategy you should all adopt. You know the deal between it's unusual strategy in a way, because when they rolled it out, they didn't have any idea how popular it would be, but they now have. It's an embarrassing number, but $100 million worth of your money sitting in their bank account waiting for you to spend it. So in the old days, you would go in and give them cash when you bought the cup of coffee. Now you give them cash ahead of time. Woohoo! Good for the stock. Thank you. Keep doing that. But it's an incredible... Anyway, back to First Data. So First Data helped create that stored value card, but they're in a commoditized business. Do you know what a commoditized business is? What's a commoditized business, Douglas? Nobody cares. Are you in a commoditized... No. Nobody cares what product... No, I'm sorry. Rip. I'm going to back up and say it all over again. You're absolutely right, Douglas. Nobody cares about the differentiation of commoditized products. There's no differentiation in the commoditized products. I'm so sorry. Jeez. Now you're not going to take me to Honolulu, are you? All right, commoditized products. Here's an example: the mousetrap. Does anybody care if it's pink or blue? No. All you want is dead mice cheap, right? That's a truly commoditized product. Do you have commoditized products? Are you being commoditized? So First Data is being commoditized. There are lots of people who are issue and process credit cards. They've got to figure out this blue ocean strategy of how to drive costs down while differentiating the service proposition and creating differentiation by driving the cost down to their customers. Walmart's done this very well. So they needed to benchmark. You think they benchmarked against other banks, other financial institutions? What do you think they benchmarked against? I guarantee you'll never get this. They went to Toyota. They sent their engineers to Japan and said, we're going to benchmark. What we're going to do is try to figure out what Toyota's doing in this thing called lean manufacturing and Six Sigma. We're going to take that from the manufacturing of automobiles and turn it into the manufacturing, the processing, and the issuing of credit cards. I got to watch this in Omaha, Nebraska. So basically what it was costing them about a buck to get that little debit card through their process and then send it out to you, they got it down to about 70 cents. That 30 cents was the margin that then helped them become profitable, but also helped them capture more customers because when they save money, they help pass that on to their customers and they got a lot more business. They got to drive their revenue substantially higher. They benchmark way, 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 way outside their industry. I think you should do the same. So what about decisions? Here's the key. Do your frontline employees, those people answering the phone every day, do they know how to make decisions on your behalf, understanding the alignment of your strategy? How many people say yes? How many people are lying? Yeah, okay. My suggestion and my suspicion is that most organizations don't have this alignment of decision making. And how your customers perceive you, I think. I mean, I know from taking my dogs to the local clinics, I know for a fact that a lot of the judgment I have is how I'm treated at the front door. I always like it when a cat greets me or a dog greets me. You know, you walk in, it's a clinic. There should be a cat or dog at the front door, shouldn't there? Yeah. By the way, you guys know this, but there's some psychology to that. Calms you down a little bit. Makes you feel good because it's always a nice dog or a nice cat, right? But how you're greeted at the front door and the decisions that are made on your behalf for your strategic plan are made by people that probably don't know have a clue about your strategy. Is that true or not true? It's kind of true. Let's just go on. I bet it is true to a certain degree. They make operational decisions, and operational decisions should be in alignment with the strategic decisions. Yeah, you like this guy? You know him? Jim Collins, lives up in Boulder, Colorado now. Wrote a book called Good to Great. He was on the cover. This is from a cover of Fortune magazine last summer. He says this about decisions. Decisions mean inviting uncertainty into your home, offering it a drink, and asking it to stay for dinner. What's that mean? What do you think that means? What's your name?
I'm hiding it well.
You're hiding it well. Hey, Stu, what do you think that means? And you got to sleep with it. Anybody make a decision that kind of twisted their guts for a while? You guys have a pretty substantial investment in your practices, I bet. Do you have to borrow big money, get big investors? I love this guy. I was upstairs looking at the convention hall upstairs, and the Simi Valley Veterinary. Did you guys see this? Oh my God, it's gorgeous! I can't imagine the amount of money this person put into the real estate in the Simi Valley. You know, that's sort of that wine growing region. Simi Valley, California, and it's, you know, it's got all of the latest marble and, you know, did you see this? Oh my God, it's gorgeous. It's got to be millions and millions of dollars. Is that a gut-wrenching decision? Yeah. It's a gut-wrenching decision. Do you want a good return on that investment? Do your bankers and your investors want to get some money back? Yeah. How are we going to get there? Yeah, let's figure this out. How about a systematic process through which an organization agrees, builds commitment among its key stakeholders? To priorities which are essential to its mission and responsive to the operational environment. We want to get commitment from all of our stakeholders to follow along on this strategy. It's about building commitment. Yeah. It creates a forum for understanding why the organization exists and what the shared values are. It fosters successful communication, teamwork amongst the board and the staff, amongst the owners and the people who execute on the strategy. It's all about meaningful change. I think strategy, by the way, do you guys feel the need to change? The need to, are you in a changing environment? Oh my God. Yeah, people expect tile floors and they expect marble counters now. They expect the highest, the latest and greatest in technology, right? You are a part of the leadership process that says we've got to figure out how to change in a dynamic way. Part of leadership, if you sort of parse that word out, big part of leadership, the thing that distinguishes leadership from management, in my mind at least, is the word change. And do you have to change? Do you have to innovate? We're going to talk about that a lot more. So this is what, for me, and lots of different processes, one of the things that I found, by the way, I do strategic planning for Fortune 500 companies. I do strategic planning for very small organizations. I actually love it, doing strategic planning for nonprofit, pro bono. So you got nonprofits, give me a call. But I do, I love to do strategic planning, but here's a funny thing about strategic planning. I always send out a couple of articles to get everybody to read before we start the process. A couple of reasons for that, but here's the number one reason. You got to get people to get over the idea of what's a strategy, what's an objective, and what's a tactic. People are going to fight. I've had this happened to me in several times. I was doing a strategic planning session with a company called Great Western Western Gas. It sold out to Anadarko recently. I wish I could take credit for it. I can't. But I was doing strategic planning for them about a year ago. And we spent the first 4 hours in the board meeting just arguing what the difference between these two words were, strategy and objective. I would strongly suggest, you know, in my mind, it doesn't really matter what the definition is as long as you can agree beforehand and then go forward as a team and use the same lexicon and use it in a way that works. One of the things I would suggest, do you guys ever have this trouble, Brian? Arguing about lexicon, what's a strategy, what's a tactic, what's an objective? Yeah. So they just told you what it was and you accepted it? Yeah. They look like a powerful bunch. I'd listen to them too. Yeah. Good. That's a good answer. And once you do this, for a while, you start getting over that idea. But you can waste so much time just arguing about the lexicon. So move on. I'm going to illustrate this a little bit for you too, by the way. The first thing you want to do with strategic planning is probably create this vision. I want to illustrate that. I'm actually going to ask you to do a little homework tonight. Is it okay? I'm a college professor. Did you know there was going to be a quiz? It's okay. It's an easy quiz. You can brainstorm. You can collaborate with a bunch of people. You can cheat. You can look at use Wikipedia or yeah, whatever. I'm going to ask you to do a little process because I want you to start thinking about your organization, your clinics, whatever part you might be. I'm going to ask you to start putting together some strategies, some objectives and tactics. What this looks like at the end of the day is like a big decision tree. So most organizations, when you start the process, you're looking for two or three strategies. Focus is a big part of this, so keep them small. Two or three strategies, and for each strategy, you should have two or three objectives, two or three tactics, and several measurements. So you have two or three strategies, each one of those have two or three, you get it, it's kind of a tree with roots. And so what you're trying to do is build this tree diagram that starts with strategies and ends up with measurements for everything that gets there. I'll illustrate. One of the things that we're going to do, by the way, is figure out trade-offs. I don't know, have you guys, anybody seen this book? It's called Blue, yeah. Have you ever seen this book? Yeah, let me try that. Yeah, it's a test. Blue Ocean Strategies. It's one of the books that I'm going to recommend that if you're into strategic planning or into innovation at all, I use it as a textbook for an innovation class I teach now. But it's really about being innovative and creative in the process of strategic thinking and strategic planning. It's how to be innovative. It's how to use your right brain as opposed to just all the data in your left brain to figure out better strategies and to get to what's called blue ocean. I'll illustrate that in a minute. But in this, one of the things that they suggest is that the strongest part of a strategy is what you take out as well as what you put in. Part of the creative process is reducing things that cost money, that cost energy, but don't add value. So, first part of strategy is a trade-off. It's a trade-off. Now, I'm going to use a guy named Michael Tracy. You ever heard of him? Yeah, it doesn't matter. I'm a college professor. I have to hear about these guys. Don't worry about the names, but I have to give them credit. So Michael Tracy is actually a brilliant guy from Boston. And he says that when you're doing this process, you should think about being the best at one of these three disciplines: operational excellence, customer intimacy, product leadership. Coming back to that in a second. But the idea is be the best. Be a perfectionist at one of these. Probably one of them in your business is going to make sense. We'll get to that in a second. But be the best at one of them. And then achieve adequate performance level at the other two, always trying to improve your superior position, because you got to watch out for number four here. This is a fact of the competitive environment. This is a fact of strategy. This is a fact of war, and you're in war. Keep becoming more adequate in the other two disciplines because your competitors are going to keep raising your customers' expectations. Yeah. If all of a sudden your customers have the latest and greatest technology, they have the marble counter and the MRI machines and the mobile X-ray clinic. If they have them, your customers' expectations. If your competitors remember every customer's name when they walk in the door, they know the dog's name, the pet's name, whatever it might be. Yeah, that's a competitive advantage for them. You've got to beware of that because your competitors are always raising the expectations of your customers. So, let me illustrate this, and we're going to get into this idea of trade-offs. You got to pick. You got to trade off something. And these two are almost diametrically opposed. Let me see if I can illustrate. Operational excellence. Operational excellence, poster child for operational excellence is Walmart, Dell Computers. What they have done is disintermediate. That's one of those MBA marketing words. They're taking costs out, eliminating the middleman, taking costs out so they can drive the prices down to their customers. They're operationally excellent. They're operationally efficient because every time every part of their strategy has to do with that one focus of driving costs down, always low prices. Dell's done the same thing. Dell raised the expectation from a pricing point of view for everybody in this room because those Dell commercials, you see that I can get a laptop for $600 or $700, I can get a desktop for $400, and if I get a student discount, maybe even less. They raised the expectation of the competitors of people like HP and Apple and Compaq and everybody else, raised the expectation. Boy, tough. But operational excellence, now, is operational excellence a part of your strategy? I work with a lot of, not a lot, but we work with Kaiser Permanente. We do work with them. And it's really interesting to me to hear their planning sessions. They've gotten really good at the high technology, and they really have gotten operationally excellent at processing the highest number of patients per day. So I'm talking to a pediatrician, and somebody's got her scheduled every 15, 20 minutes. So I would say that is diametrically opposed to this word. That's not a word, it's a phrase. Customer intimacy. Customer intimacy is Nordstrom, Starbucks. It's knowing your customers and getting to pay a much higher margin because you provided some sort of differentiated customer service. You guys all know stories about Nordstrom's? You know the story about the tires? Stories about suits that get shipped all over? Yeah. Carl, you know this story? No? Nordstrom's is famous for customer intimacy. The story that's told, and it's in a variety of books, and Nordstrom talks about this all the time. It's illustrative, and I'll tell you why it's illustrative in a second, but here's the story. Customer walks into Nordstrom's one day, he's got a pair of tires. Nordstrom's had bought a business, an existing business that had one time sold tires. Nordstrom's never sold tires, right? But they had a building and they were taking over a building, and this customer walks into Nordstrom's one day, walks up to the counter and goes, "Hey, your tires are no good." I think they use a different word. "But your tires are no good, I want my money back." What do you think that frontline employee at the cashier, what did that employee say? We say what? Yes, they said yes. They said yes. Would your frontline employee say yes? It's illustrative for a reason. I'll get to it. The frontline employee, the hourly retail employee said, "Sure. How much did you pay for him?" No receipt. Guy said $200. I said, "Okay. Open the register. Here's $200. Thank you very much. Take the tires." Now, why is that illustrative? Why is that? They tell this story over and over and over again. Why do they tell it over and over again, Debbie? They tell it inside Nordstrom's. No questions asked. That is probably the best training mechanism. If you understand that you're an employee for Nordstrom's and you give people their money back no matter if they have a receipt, you don't say no thank you. You know, how many people, have anybody ever treated like that at the local tire shop? Take your tires back, these tires suck, here's your money back. Never happened to me. It's illustrative because as they tell that story over and over again, people get that if you're a frontline employee, that's the way you make decisions. It's the best training mechanism in the world. And it really is all about customer intimacy. Now, are those two diametrically opposed? Yeah, perhaps. The third one is product leadership, but I think maybe all three of these can apply to you. Let's see. Product leadership is, yeah, this is about the iPod. By the way, did Apple invent the MP3 player? Anybody got an MP3 player? Can I have the MP3 player that you're giving away tonight?
No, you can't.
I can't. Damn. You're going to give it to one of these people?
Yeah.
Damn.
If they win the drawing.
If they win the drawing. Okay, yeah. Apple didn't invent the MP3 player. They just innovated the marketing of it from a product superiority. They did not invent the technology at all. In fact, they got sued for using the technology. It's gotten past that now. But what they did was they figured out how to commercialize it, innovate it, and got it to their customers in an incredible way. They got product leadership without creating the technology. Key. Lexus, they didn't invent luxury cars, but they innovated the process. They innovated customer service in a way. And by the way, the first story of Lexus was a recall. You guys all know that story? They sent their cars out. The first car was about 87. Big, it was 87, somewhere around there. They sent all these Lexuses out, sold them for a high price. Big product recall, big failure. They got them back. They said, oh, my God, what are we going to do? We're trying to sell luxury cars, and the first thing we're going to do is recall them. They washed your car. They filled it up with gas. They sent you a personal letter of apology. They went to your house, picked up the car, took it to the Lexus dealer, fixed it, brought it back. When they brought it back, it was washed, full of gas, and a personal letter of apology. Customer intimacy, yeah, and product leadership. How does product leadership apply in your business? Does it? How about if we change the word to service leadership? Yeah, product or service leadership. I think it does apply. It does apply. Now, these two can go hand in hand, I think. And by the way, from a blue ocean strategy point of view, you've always got to be figuring out how to be more operationally efficient. Because you have to drive down costs. You got to learn to do more with less. You got to innovate. Yep. Yeah. Is this depressing for you? Well, back to my Kaiser story. I think it's a really hard combination. So the Kaiser doctors, and I like Kaiser. I'm not bad mouthing Kaiser. They pay me. I can't. But the idea is that there is a conflict. But even though there is that conflict where they're trying to get a certain number of patients a day, do you guys need to be... In the restaurant business, we called it throughput. Starbucks, yeah, sorry. You probably don't want to know this, but we called you throughput. Yeah. Throughput means how many customers can I get through that line? How fast can I get them through that line? Throughput's very important because in the retail world, if somebody walks by a Starbucks or a coffee shop, they see three or four people in line, they'll go to the next one. That may not be a Starbucks, maybe something else. They see a Burger King and you got five cars in the drive-through window, they'll go to Taco Bell or Pizza Hut or whatever. So there's this thing called line abandonment. Do you have line abandonment because the lines are too long? Is there a way for you to be operationally efficient so that you don't turn customers away when they call? Sure, we can bring you in. Sure, you can come in right now. Sure, we can take care of that. Is there a way for you to be operationally efficient and customer intimate at the same time? I actually think there is. I think that's one of the challenges. It's one of the innovative challenges to making high margins and good plans in your businesses. If you can figure this out, and by the way, I don't think it's easy. I don't think it's easy at all. And it's something that Kaiser's doing right now. They're working very hard on the idea is how do you make people feel great about service that takes place in a nanosecond? How do you make people feel great about the service I got from my doctor, even though my doctor only spent 15 minutes. It is possible. I love my doctor, Dr. Sonia Black, right over here on Broadway. Love this woman. You know why I love her? It's not because of the time she spends with me, because now it's all high tech. She sends me emails. I send her an email. She sends me an email back. I don't have to go see her anymore. Yeah. No, not quite true. But it's become so much more operationally efficient because she's taken advantage of something Jim Collin called technological accelerators. She accelerates her ability to deal with more people on an intimate basis because she's used technology to interact with me. Does that make sense? Quick story. You know, every year you go in and get your blood test, find out if you're going to, you need cholesterol drugs or whatever. Usually, you know, I'd take 2 or 3 weeks. I got in a fight with a doctor. I hope you like this, but I got my dog, my Labrador's blood test back twice as fast as my own human test from the doctor that I no longer go to see. So I called up my doctor one day and said, listen, I'm kind of cranky because my Labrador test came back in, 3 days. Yours taking 2 weeks. He goes, well, you're not a dog. I said, yeah, I don't want to be treated like one either. So Kaiser, what they do now is you get your blood test. This happened, last fall. They draw your blood at 9 o'clock in the morning. By about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I had an email told me all my blood. You guys do that? Can you take advantage of technological accelerators? send email to your, you know, you got to watch out for, you guys have to watch out for HIPAA? In the human practice, you have to watch it. You don't care about HIPAA. Good. Good. So here's what a, by the way, I want to go back to this a second. So in here, we're doing trade-offs. The very first part of this is a trade-off. It's a trade-off between customer intimacy, operational excellence, product or service superiority. I want to touch on this. There's also a product leadership in here. There is product. There's service leadership, absolutely. But there's also product leadership because you guys have to keep upgrading your all that stuff on the second floor, right? All those products, all those technological accelerators that are up there, things that I can't pronounce, tests that I don't want to know about. But you guys have to keep upgrading and investing a lot of money. And is there a competitive advantage to having better facilities? Marble counters. Yeah, probably. Yeah. Okay. So here's how I think a strategic planning session ought to go. This is how I did mine in SS Park. Here's the controversial part, but I think this worked, and I can prove it worked at Starbucks and at Port La France. The first thing that we did was we went about 6 months in advance of the retreat, 6 months in advance of the actual strategic planning session, we created these forms. The forms ask our employees, our frontline employees, what are we absolutely the best at? Why do our customers come to our cafes or bakeries? What is it that we do that people see as being better? What is it that differentiates this business in the minds of our customer? That's all that matters, by the way. It only matters what the customer sees. So the first thing we did for 6 months in advance, we created these forms, and we drove them all away at the lowest level. The lowest level. We literally asked the dishwashers, the busboys, the wait staff, bartenders, we asked them all. They were basically interviewed by the store managers. The store managers then cascaded that up to district managers, vice presidents, etc. So that when we got to the strategic planning session 6 months later, we had this roll-up of what the stakeholders... By the way, everybody understand that term stakeholder? Stakeholders are people who love your organization for one reason or another. They are customers. They are stockholders. They are people who depend on you because they're maybe your landlord. They're people who supply you your products. They're all the way up and down the value chain. Stakeholders have a stake in your success, and they want you to be successful. Their customers want you to be successful. Your suppliers want you to be your stockholders. Yeah, they want you to be successful. So you interview them all. Take some time. Create a form. What are we great at? I'll help you with some of these ideas. Then you create a vision. What do we want to be when we grow up? Do visions have to be true? No. They have to be based on reason, but they don't have to be true yet. My favorite vision, John F. Kennedy, 1961, said, within this decade, we'll put a man on the moon and bring him back safely to Earth. Safely is a key word. In 1961, we had something like 20 seconds of manned spaceflight. If you remember 19... Yeah, nobody's old enough. I'm the only one who's old enough. But I'll explain to you what it looked like in 1961. We had these rocket ships that would go up like this. They'd kind of bend over like this, and then somebody would push a button and blow it up because it wasn't going where it was supposed to go. Yeah. Somebody else remembers that. Good, I'm glad. But we weren't very good at it. 1961, John F. Kennedy said, you know what? We're going to put a man safe on the moon and bring him back safely. It was crazy. Everybody thought he was with John Denver, Rocky Mountain High. It was not possible. This vision was not possible, but it was reasonable. We'd seen the moon. We've always wanted to go there. There was an impetus to do so. A guy named Carl Larson, who's a professor at DU, worked on the Apollo project. He's a communications, a PhD in communication. He interviewed these Apollo rocket scientists in the years after 1969 when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And he said these guys their vocation and their avocation were absolutely parallel. They loved having these ideas, these brainstorming sessions. They'd have these half a brain looking for the other. They'd call 3 o'clock in the morning, I got a new idea for how we might put this connector on, whatever, something technical that I don't understand. Call up a couple of others, rocket scientists. Let's meet at the lab, 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah! Yeah. 3 days later, they'd leave. They loved what they were doing. They understood the vision, and I think understanding the vision's pretty key. You want to focus on strategies that will accomplish that vision, and then you want to build the objectives. Again, this is kind of where we went to, and then you want to measure it all. You end up with something like this little form that my friends at ECC created, where people are carrying these around in their briefcases. They're putting on, this actually goes on their PDAs. Put it on cell phones these days, but it looks like this. And so everybody's in alignment, and they understand, that they're supposed to measure whether the decisions they're making are in alignment with the strategy. Seems like a good idea, doesn't it? Yeah. All right. So back to Blue Ocean. The idea behind, I think, behind building strategies is that first word, focus. When I created the strategic plan for Port La France, the thing that probably worked best of anything else was that first word, focus. What are you absolutely the best at? What is it that absolutely you know, there's a issue about whether or not you should be a perfectionist. And this is what I believe. You get to believe what you choose. But I believe that you should be a perfectionist at one thing. Shouldn't be a perfectionist in general, by the way. That'll drive all your friends and neighbors crazy. But if you can be a perfectionist at just one thing and really, really, really just be the best at it as an individual and as an organization, really, really, really focus on that one thing. And then once you figure out that one thing, figure out how to diverge enough within that frame of that one focus so that you really have a differentiation in the marketplace, so that your customers see you as being absolutely the best at that one focus. So what is that for you guys? What is that one focus? What is it that your practices, your clinics, your organization, what is it that you're absolutely the best at? Sleepy dog. And then you got to come up with a compelling tagline. Compelling tagline. Absolutely, positively, has to be delivered overnight. Remember Federal Express? Everybody in the organization, if you work for Federal Express, you understood that compelling tagline. Absolutely, positively, must be delivered overnight by 10 o'clock the next morning. Compelling tagline. You want to hear? Yeah, I'm going to. You don't want. You're going to hear a story about that compelling tagline. So this really worked for Federal Express. Here's a story. This was told by Fred Smith, the founder. Fred Smith's a weird guy. Fred Smith wrote the business plan for Federal Express as an MBA student. Got a C on it. I think he just didn't do his homework. But anyway, got a C on it. Said, screw it, I'm going to do it anyway. Did it. But a couple of years into it, he was about to go bankrupt. Decided the only way he was going to keep from going bankrupt, he had to make payroll. The only way he was going to keep from going bankrupt was he took one of his own Federal Express planes, flew to Las Vegas, put his entire assets on the roulette table. Black. Yeah, oh my God. It came up. Flew back to Memphis, made payroll. It's been a success story ever since. But he tells that story to all of his employees, how he came this close and gambled their payroll on the roulette table in Las Vegas one night. Yeah. Illustrative for a reason I'm going to get to in a second. So in the early 90s, there was a bad snowstorm in Memphis. Memphis is where Federal Express, they fly all their planes in, they change cargo overnight, then they fly all back out. In the middle of the night, there was a bad snowstorm. They require a lot of electronics to get the planes to come in, and they require a lot of electronic communication so that they understand which package in advance. They've got to know which packages are going to which plane, and they have this all figured out ahead of time before the planes land. Communication tower had been knocked out by a snowstorm. Knocked out. This wasn't going to work, and absolutely positively just wasn't going to happen. One of the hour employees that was a technology guy, an IT guy, said, you know what? I can fix that tower, but I'm going to have to rent a helicopter. Fred's gone. I'll just rent a helicopter. Fred's going to understand. Anybody think they could rent a helicopter for their business and the owner not get a little pissed off? A couple $1,000 an hour. So the guy rents a helicopter. He's crazy. Rents a helicopter. He flies up to this mountain, the hills of above Memphis in Tennessee, flies up, gets to the control tower, figure that's the one. I got to fix it. The helicopter pilot says, forget it. We can't land. The trees are too close. He says, just get me close. There's a lot of snow. I'll jump. Yeah. He says it's a true story. I don't know. That you can test the veracity. So he jumps, soft snore. He apparently didn't have to jump that far. He wasn't hurt too bad. Climbs up the tower, fixes it, fixes the device. Absolutely positively, everything got delivered overnight. Because this guy rented a helicopter, took it to the top of the mountain, jumped out, fixed it, and then hiked out in a snowstorm. Now, what does that story have to do with the roulette story? Are they illustrative? I think they are. Because Fred Smith inspired this entrepreneurial spirit. He knew that he wouldn't get fired for renting a helicopter in the middle of the night in Memphis, Tennessee. He knew that Fred Smith had gambled himself and encouraged entrepreneurial spirit as long as you're taking care of the customer. as long as you're being true to the tagline, as long as you're being true to the mission. Yeah. What do you think? Do you guys have a tagline? A couple other taglines. Priceless. That's a tagline, right? Everybody, I say the word priceless, what do you think about? MasterCard. A great, some sort of a great event, taking care of your kids, taking them to a ball game. There's some sort of a great event because of the word priceless. Do you have a tagline? We think you should have all three of these. Focus, divergence, and a great tagline. I'm going to give you a couple of illustrations. So, I hope you find this a funny story. No, I'm not drunk. But you might think I am in a minute. I'm out jogging. I like to run. So I was in San Francisco, and I'm running around the South Bay, a place called Burlingame. I stay in the hotel. You got to go for a run because you stay in a hotel too long. Well, you guys know that. So I'm running around, and there's a truck. And this is the tagline on the truck. Go nuts. Anything come to mind yet? This is your business, by the way. I thought that was a compelling tagline. Made me cross my knees. What do you think? I think that's a compelling tagline. You guys have a compelling tagline like that? Big trucks, they had several of them. Go nuts. All right, you get it. So, I'm going to segue now a little bit from the overview of strategy into personal innovation, because here's a part of the strategy that I think is important. I think it's time for you to try to figure out how you can be more creative. How can you be more innovative? Can you? Anybody think they're creative here? If I would have said to you when you were in second grade, write me a poem. How many people would have done it? It's 100%. I'm sorry. You did it. You know you did it. Maybe it was roses are red and violets are blue, but you wrote a poem when you were in second grade. If I'd have said, paint me a painting in second grade, how many people would have done it? You all would have done it. So why, when I say now, are you creative? Only Cindy raised her hand. Was it Cindy or Debbie? Which one of you raised your hand? Only one of you raised your hand. What, did somebody beat it out of you? No. You have creativity and you have innovation inside of you. You do. You have tons of it. But maybe 15 or 20 years of school beats it out of you. And I'm a professor, so I can say this. I think it does. I think your job in this next step of the process is to try to find more of that creative spot. How can you get more innovation? How can you get more creativity? By the way, when I say innovation, what I really mean is commercialization of maybe somebody else's idea, the iPod. I don't mean the creative process in terms of Michelangelo. I kind of like the guy. I don't mean that process. What I mean is taking somebody else's idea and figuring out how to innovate in a commercialized way. Innovation doesn't count at all. Innovation doesn't count at all if you can't get it to market. If you can't get a customer to pay for it. Google, one of the most innovative companies in the world, has figured out how to innovate and commercialize it. So, from Blue Ocean Strategy, here's part of where we want to get innovative. Here's where we want to get creative, and I'm going to help you with a couple of processes. The idea of Blue Ocean, it's uncharted water. It's wide open. And by the way, does it seem weird that even in your practices that we would talk about a Blue Ocean Strategy? Because, you know, how innovative can you be? I think you can be very innovative. We're going to talk about, you guys never know anything about the wine industry? Is that pretty competitive? Anybody want to sample some right now and make me shut up? Yeah. Not an option. Shut the door, Constance. Yeah. Ah, sure. So you're going for the wine. Okay, Constance. The wine industry, the wine industry is incredibly red ocean. My wife's in the wine industry for 25 years. We buy wine. There's nobody's loyal to wine anymore. You used to buy Fetzer or Korbel or something. You were loyal to it. There are thousands of different Chardonnays, Pinot Noirs, Cabernet Sauvignons out there. Thousands and thousands of them. It's a very, very competitive market, just like the market you guys are in. There's a company called Yellowtail. Ever heard of Yellowtail? What's true of Yellowtail? Brandy. You were shaking your head. It's cheap wine. Yep, it's good. It's Australian cheap wine. Those crazy Australians. Here's what's true about Yellowtail. They came into a bloody red ocean of competition. In 2 years, they went from an unknown winery to being the number one imported wine in the U.S. right now. Do you know that? Yellowtail wine, number one imported. All these old wines from Bola and Suave and from Italy, and all these wines have been imported for hundreds of years. Yellowtail, number one. How'd they do it? How'd they do it? They figured out a blue ocean strategy in a really, really competitive process. I'm going to illustrate for you. Here's a secret, though. It has to do with beer, not with wine. It has to do with benchmarking outside the industry, looking for people that are maybe just graduating from beer. Yeah, first date, 24, 25, is that? That's true, yeah. 24, 25, you got your first date, you've been drinking beer all your life, but the girl, the guy is coming over for the first time. Don't have a clue what Pouilly Foussé means. Oh, yeah. But I do know what Yellowtail wine is. I'm a beer drinker. I'm switching to Yellowtail. It's not intimidating. Don't swim with the school. Quit benchmarking the competition against your industry. Go outside. Be First Data. Go check out Toyota. Look for new ponds to fish. Don't assume your current customers have the insights you need to rethink your strategy. Henry Ford had a great quote. Henry Ford said, if I'd asked my customers what they wanted in 1905, what do you think they would have said? I want a faster horse. They didn't know the possibilities. Do your customers know the possibilities? I think part of your job is to innovate, create possibilities, and then take them back to your customers, like Henry Ford. They don't know what the possibilities are. Part of your job is to be that creative, innovative. You're supposed to go out and look across the industries, and you got to always cut bait on costs. So this is sort of in alignment with the idea of how you get there. I love this woman. Don't know her. She doesn't know me. That's Marissa Meyer. She's kind of the head of innovation. Her official title is Vice President of Search Products and User Experience. Here's what she says about innovation. And by the way, Marissa Meyer may be one of the most innovative people you know in the innovative circle. You know, Google's kind of doing okay here, aren't they? Ideas come from everywhere. Very important. Share everything you can. Is that counterintuitive from a leadership perspective? Is it counterintuitive to share everything you know with everybody around you? What Marissa Meyer says is when you share, you get a bigger pie. When you come in with a half a brain, you come out with a brain and a half. You get this thing called synergy, 1 plus 1 equals 17. Marissa Meyer says that sharing will help you. She says, always hire brilliant people. Hire people who are hungry, humble, and smart. That's kind of intuitive, right? You don't want to hire people who are arrogant, satiated, and stupid. You want to hire people hungry, humble, and smart. Actually, it's a line from Patrick Lencioni, but hire people who are brilliant. Hire people who are smarter than you and ask them to collaborate and help you. Build a license inside your organization to pursue dreams. Innovation is not instant perfection. It's messy, right? It's a messy thing. Don't politic, use data. How about this one? Creativity loves constraints. What do you think? Is that a fair statement? Creativity loves constraints. Yeah. You're shaking your head, and I love that, Carl, but why?
You have to have pain in order to be motivated to create. Mm-hmm. Constraints are what cause pain.
Mm-hmm. Pain is one of the great motivators. And learning from your pain, Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Man's Search for Meaning is this idea of a little bit of suffering is good to come out the other side. Yeah. Creativity loves constraints. Michelangelo said the sculpture's already in the marble. Somebody gives him a block of marble. The sculpture's all already in the marble. My idea is my job is just to let it out, just to free the marble, just to free the constraints of the marble. But it already is in that block of marble. If I said to you, write a poem, you would struggle. If I said, write four lines starting with roses are red and ending up with violet, yeah, you could do it really fast. Creativity loves constraints. Better example is Starbucks. If I said to somebody, you're working for Starbucks, I want you to be creative, I want you to be innovative, and you went out and tried to figure out, how to bring music in, but they're bringing music in now, aren't they? Yeah, they're selling music, but you want to bring in the world's greatest French fries. It doesn't work. Creativity loves constraints. You're in a veterinarian practice, in a hospital clinic, whatever it might be, you've got to innovate within that. You're not going to sell used cars. Probably not going to sell iPods or music either. Creativity loves constraint. Worry about usage and users, not money. Marissa Meyer says, don't worry if you're on the innovative side. When you're doing the strategic planning process, don't worry about where we're going to commercialize this. Just get innovative. Then we'll get the revenue generation later. Don't kill projects. Just morph them into something else. All right. So I told you there was going to be a test. I've given you a few tools. Now I'm going to ask you to do this. You can do this as a group. I'm just going to give you a couple of minutes. But I want you to write down 10 words or phrases that you would like your customer to use. You would like your customers to use to describe your business. Right? Be as detailed and as future-oriented as possible. 10 words or phrases that describe what you would like your customers, future-oriented, within this decade type stuff. Are you cutting me off? Don't think about these too hard. All right, hold those. We're going to come back to that. So, this might help you a little bit. We'll see. There's a lot of ideas about innovation and thinking sort of this in a creative mind. There's a lot of research. A guy named Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called Blink. It's about thin slicing. You know this book, Greg? Greg? Yes. Do you know the book? You want to give a book report? I told you there was going to be a test. I'm a college professor, damn it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There's a guy named Daniel Pink and Malcolm Gladwell, and there's been a lot of research on human beings. They haven't done it on animals yet, but they've done it on human beings, and here's the basic research. Your left brain is your data side. It's the CPU side of your brain, and you just pack that full of brain, but pack that left brain full of data. So you go to college, you read books, you learn, you go to all the other seminars that have been here in the last 3 days about whatever that stuff is. You go and you pack that left brain full of data. Your right brain is the creative intuitive side. And what you need to do is develop both sides of your brain. Our left brain is that side that we've been working on all of our lives, trying to pack it full of data in a way that we can then use the right brain to figure out new connections. It's the connection between beer drinkers and wine drinkers at Yellowtail Wine. So you pack your left brain full of data, and here's the story I love from Blink, but it basically says this. He says they did this a test of emergency cardiologists at Cook County Medical Center in Chicago. You know this? Yeah. So in Chicago, it's, you know, inner city emergency room, and the doctors were very rushed. They had to figure out very quickly whether a person was having a heart attack or not. They did this over a two-year period. The two-year period went like this. During that two-year, Malcolm Gladwell asked the cardiologist to do two things. Put them through the normal tests that you would, and it will take a number of hours, in some cases days, to find out through the EKG and the blood markers and all that to find out if the person was having a heart attack. Do that for sure. That's safe. But when they first walk in the door, ask them three questions. You know, and I'm not a cardiologist, so the questions I would ask would be irrelevant. But you would ask them these three questions and then instantly use your intuition and determine whether or not they're having a heart attack. 90% of the time, they were more accurate with the three questions than they were with all the tests. Yeah. Now, I said, would this work for me? If you're walking in with a heart attack and I ask you three questions, would I be able to do this? Why not, Heidi? I haven't packed my left brain full of data. I packed it full of useless data, not the kind of data that might be useful for you. But you got to pack your left brain full of data and then free up your intuition, your intuitive side. I bet you can do the same thing in your practices. It's part of this innovative intuition. So the idea, again, is how do you use your right brain? Your right brain is a muscle just like your left brain. And if you don't exercise it, it won't be there when you need it. Your right brain needs to be exercised. And here's some examples of how you might want to do that. See different, be different. Look at economic indicators. Look at what's going on in the world and try to predict. Start practicing your intuition. Practice your intuition. Sometimes you'll be right, sometimes you'll be wrong. Be a novelty addict. What's new and what's not? Anybody know who that guy is? Crazy guy, Herb Kelleher, one of the founders of Southwest Airlines. Has Southwest Airlines been successful in an innovative space? Blue Ocean Strategy? Yeah, crazy successful. Technically, this has changed on a worldwide basis, but technically in the U.S., they're the only historically profitable airline. They're the only, all the other ones have a negative shareholder equity over the last. Now, if you declare bankruptcy like United and issue new stock, you get new shareholder equity, you're okay. But on a historical basis, United Airlines, American Airlines, Continental Airlines, they're all have negative shareholder value, shareholder equity. Negative. Herb Kelleher, wildly successful. Wildly profitable. Very profitable. Cheapest airline in the United States and the most profitable. Because he's a nutcase. Fortune magazine talked about it. Says they're interviewing Herb Kelleher. This is about 5 years ago. He's gone on to be the chairman. He's no longer CEO, but he's retiring. And they said, you know, what's one of the things you're really, really proud about from a leadership point of view? He says, one time I was taking a flight from Phoenix to Dallas. Is that a long flight? Yeah, not a long flight at all. He was taking a flight from Phoenix to Dallas. I was able to consume 6 mini bottles of Jack Daniels on that flight. This is a guy that founded one of the most successful airlines in the world, and he's bragging from a leadership point of view about how many shots of Jack Daniels he consumed on an airplane flight. Now, is that illustrative?
Yeah.
It is, isn't it? He's a novelty addict. He was testing out the service. Yeah, he's testing out his liver, probably. But he was testing out the service. He's a novelty addict. Can you be a novelty addict? Can you test out things? Yeah, I'm not suggesting that we all fire down 6 shots of Jack Daniels until at least 8 o'clock. Find the discontinuities. Find the things that are changing. Lifestyle. Now, are there trends in the human healthcare business that might be applicable? Is there a baby boomer generation that's applicable? Do baby boomers now have more money to spend on pets? Yeah. What about the next generation after them? Are they going to have as much money to spend? The generation is much smaller. But there are some things going on. What's that?
I said, as a member, I can say no.
You're not going to have as much money as my brother? Yeah, you're not calling me as old as your dad, are you?
No.
Yeah, you were. I know you were. That's okay. I outgrew my hair a long time ago. But what's going on out there? And where can you start? One of the things that they really talk about is start looking, start reading things. I mean, I strongly recommend, of course, that you always read every month AAH Trends. You always have to read that first. But one of the things that these guys talk about is start reading journals that have nothing to do with your business. Start reading journals that have, you know, electronic journals or car racing magazines or fashion magazines, whatever it might be, that have nothing to do with your business, but look for trends that can help you see opportunities for innovation in your own organization. Read about read about Starbucks. Read about Southwest Airlines. Read about Nordstrom's, and can you apply that backwards? Search out those unappreciated trends, things that about the butterfly theory? You guys all know about the butterfly theory. Yeah, what's the butterfly theory, Heidi? Right. A butterfly flapping its wings in Brazil this week will cause a snowstorm in the Himalayas 2 weeks from now. The point of which is, what are the unintended consequences of a little tiny trend right now? Is there Viagra in the animal pet? Yeah, because that's kind of a weird trend right now, isn't it? Yeah. They used to. I shouldn't tell this story, but what the hell? I like Pfizer. They're upstairs too, but you know they marketed this for guys my age and maybe even older. But who's using it now by the bucketful? Ain't guys my age. A little younger. It's recreational. My kind of recreation. Anyway, find the big stories. I better move on. Am I going to get in trouble?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay. Shit, I'm not going to get paid again. So, a couple of lines I love. This is Terry Jones from Travelocity. This is one of those funny teas. You know, Terry Jones worked for Sabre. He created Sabre. Sabre's the guy, the software. There's brilliant technology behind American Airlines reservation system. When he worked for them, American Airlines created the frequent flyer miles. They brought two trends together like Yellowtail did with beer. Do you know what the two trends were? Do you know who really invented the frequent flyer miles? This guy from S&H Green Stamps. Okay, who's old enough to remember what S&H Green Stamps are? God, I love this crowd. So in S&H Green Stamps, you know, you go to the store, you know, your mom buys you $100 worth of groceries, you take them back, you paste them in, you get a toaster a year later or so, right? I got a 12-gauge shotgun. Yeah, and I probably shouldn't tell you that, but I lived in eastern Colorado. I loved to go hunting when I was a kid. No, I wouldn't do that anymore, but I got a 12-gauge, literally, got a 12-gauge shotgun from S&H Green Stamps. I loved them. Now, here's the part about S&H Green Stamps that's absolutely applicable to the airline industry. Anybody figure this out? Loyalty and stickiness. Anybody else addicted to frequent flyer miles on United or American? Anybody pay, you know, $20 or $30 extra, especially if somebody else is paying? If somebody else is paying, that somebody else is paying, then you're going to take United because, you know, I get to take my wife to Europe every year or two. Yeah. We're sticky and loyal. So the idea that Terry Jones talks about where these two trends came together is S&H Green Stamps and the airline industry. Is that weird? True story. S&H Green Stamp guy went to work for Sabre, invented American Airlines was the first frequent flyer program. Sticky, loyal. Can you use that in your industry? Sticky, loyal. You going to give away green stamps? Shotguns? Toasters? Okay, never mind. I should stop. But here's your job. Part of your job. Your job is to bring things slightly out of focus into focus for your customers. You walk in the first time, it's confusing. First time you walk into Starbucks, yeah, I'm intimidated because I hear I'm ordering a triple non-fat, extra hot, half-calf, decaf soy latte. I can't even pronounce all that stuff. Are you intimidated? Job of Starbucks is to make you feel safe, to bring things that are out of focus into focus for your customers. How many people have websites? If you don't, you should have one. Everybody should have a website these days. It's cheap. Best marketing in the world in some cases. But the first time you go to somebody's website, it's going to be out of focus. Your job is to help the customers bring it into focus. This is a different part of focus. Jeff Bezos, I heard him say this at Amazon. We worry about price like Boeing worries about gravity. Does that make sense to you? We want Boeing to be focused on gravity, right? Yeah, anybody want Boeing to be focused? Anybody flying home a couple days from now? You want Boeing to worry about gravity and have that focus. Amazon has a focus that says, we worry about price like Boeing. Yeah. What's your focus? Do you have one? Yeah. Left brain, right brain. Now, we've kind of talked about that. Another book I'd recommend. Part of what you're doing when you're designing this stuff is you need to put together these ideas. Does your plan have design concept? Design is sort of the differentiator, the iPod. We didn't invent the MP3 player, but we created a design that made it better. Design is part of the innovation process. Is there a story behind it? Do your customers walk out and tell a story about the help they got, the comfort they got, the feeling they got, the service they got, the price they got? Whatever it is that you figured out is your differentiator. But do they walk out feeling like, yeah, they're telling a story, emotional story? If you can add emotion to a cup of coffee like Starbucks, you can win, can't you? If you can figure out a way to add emotion through story. Symphony is the idea of bringing things together, cross-pollinating, collaborating. We talked about Yellowtail Wine, where they brought beer drinkers into the wine industry. We talked about Southwest Airlines. Southwest Airlines basically brought, especially in Texas in the early days, they brought people who would have taken a car into the airline industry, people who would have driven or taken a Greyhound bus. They cross-pollinated airlines with Greyhound buses. Can you cross-pollinate somehow? Empathy. Is empathy really, really important in your industry? Yeah. I've got some pictures here. I forgot there. Yeah. There's empathy. There's symphony. There's design. There's story. And, of course, play. Daniel Pink says, sobriety kills. This seems like a theme here tonight, doesn't it? It's happy hour. Sobriety kills. What's he mean by that? What do you think? Want to take a shot at that one? He's not talking about drugs or alcohol. This is not John Denver. Yeah, there you go. Boy, that's an easy one for me. But sobriety kills. The other part that they're realizing in this innovative space is that when you're laughing, you're twice as creative as when you're crying, maybe more than twice. You see these things they're called laughter clinics. They stand out in the parks these days, and people just start laughing. Yeah, I can't do it because you'll laugh. But people start laughing, and it opens up synaptic gaps that don't exist. When you're smiling and you're happy, is your workplace one of play, or what's the other one? Yeah. Is your workplace a place where people think it's so fun that they can't wait to go to work? It's collaborative and it's fun and it's interesting and they know that they can have a good time. You guys have to be serious because you're dealing with the health and well-being of people's favorite beings, at least in my case these days. But you're dealing with families. You have to be serious, but can you also play at the same time? More importantly, can you play in a way that all of your co-collaborators, your cross-pollinators feel a part of that? And the last one's meaning. That's that vocation and avocation. When your vocation and your avocation come together and you feel meaning in your work, you're going to win. High concept involves the capacity to detect patterns and opportunities to create artistic and emotional beauty. to create a satisfying narrative and to combine seemingly unrelated items into something new. So now let's figure out how to create the vision. When you're doing strategic planning, you got to start with the right goal. Do you all have a goal? You wrote down 10 things, didn't you? You wrote down 10 things, yeah. We're going to ask you to enable the company to deliver a differentiated value proposition. This was Starbucks' vision. This was actually the second one. When Howard Schultz, who was really the founder of Starbucks, he came out, this was a crazy idea, did his first IPO in 1987. He said this. He said, I have a vision where someday people will interchange the word Starbucks with coffee on a worldwide basis. Does it come true? Now, in 1987, this little coffee shop, they had about five or six of them up in Seattle. That was a hallucination, wasn't it? To think that let's go out for a Starbucks would be a phrase instead of let's go for a cup of coffee. Where Starbucks is part of the lexicon, where it's number two most admired company in the world right now. He had this vision back in the day. But here's the vision that sits on everybody's business card right now. To establish Starbucks as the premier purveyor of the finest coffee in the world while maintaining our uncompromising principles as we grow. All those words are key. Premier purveyor of the finest coffee in the world, maintaining uncompromising principles as we grow, ethics and values. Play. The one thing that they would teach you at Starbucks is that, you know, we're not in the veterinary medicine. You don't have to be serious. We can have fun here. You can spill a cup of coffee. No one's going to die over it. It's okay. One of the things that you can test this out, by the way, they believe in customer service. They measure this thing called cost of customer acquisition. Yeah. You know what that means? How much does it cost to get one new customer in the door and get them to come back? Cost of customer acquisition. Costs lots of money, $500 to $1,000 to get one new customer. Now, how much is the cost of that $5 latte to Starbucks? They will always give you a free one if you complain about the first one. They'll probably give you six or seven of them. Because the cost of that replacement is pennies. 50 cents a buck. I shouldn't tell you that. The margins are embarrassing at Starbucks. They have zero debt on their balance sheet. They finance all the store acquisition through their cash flow. It's embarrassing, yeah. But here's part of the secret to the success. Everybody in the company understands that they're going to be the best purveyor, the finest purveyor of coffee in the world, while not compromising principles, and they're going to grow. Does that all come true? Yeah. So what's a vision statement? A vision is a mental model of a future state, a process, a group, or an organization. As such, it deals with a world that exists only in the imagination. A world built upon plausible speculations fabricated from what we hope are reasonable assumptions about the future and heavily influenced by what is possible and worthwhile. That's a mouthful. Yeah. Plausible, worthwhile, something we want to do, but not necessarily true today. So, I'm going to skip that one. So we need to build a vision for your company. So here's the next step for you. What I'd like you to do is take that list of 10 words or phrases. You got that now, right? Yeah. Now I'd like you to add 10 more words or phrases that say things that make you and your organization happy and will lead to your long-term success. 10 words or phrases that make you and your organization, makes you happy to do. These are things that make you happy to take care of a pet, take care of a customer. Write down 10 words or phrases that make you happy to go to work in the morning. What makes you happy? What makes you happy? What do you love doing at work? What are you really, really, really good at work? What are you the best at? Something that you do that just makes you happy every time you get it done. What?
I already got it.
You already got it. All right. So I should stop talking to you. If you don't get 10, you're going to get like a C. But Fred Smith is okay. He got rich off of getting a C, so it's okay with you, right? No. No grades. Maybe you can only write down a couple. That's all right. So, we're going to create a vision here in a minute. I like this statement from Bert Nanus. I'm going to ask you to create a vision. So here's the idea. Vision is composed of one part foresight, seeing into the future, one part insight, what's going on right now, and often a healthy dose of chutzpah. Did I pronounce that right? Yeah, who knows? Chutzpah. What's chutzpah? It's guts. It's courage. It's having a little bit of Herb Kelleher in you. It's having a little Fred Smith in you throwing the payroll on the roulette wheel. That's chutzpah, right? But vision is a little bit chutzpah. It's about what's going on in the world, understanding the trends, the discontinuities, understanding all that, searching out unappreciated trends, but having some interesting chutzpah to maybe do something that's a little bit different. Yeah, all right. By the way, I love this guy. Peter Drucker, he's the guy that said you should be absolutely committed to your vision, or absolutely committed to your strategy, being willing to change it in the face of a new market. He says, never subordinate the mission in order to get money. Have you guys seen, there's a huge trend right now in the business world. It's private equity. You know what's going on? Private equity, big organizations are taking public companies private again. A couple of different reasons. There's never one answer to these things, but one of the reasons that companies are going from public corporations to private is because of the focus on quarterly earnings. Quarterly earnings, in terms of strategy, is almost an oxymoron. Quarterly earnings and reporting quarterly earnings. Google, Sergey and Brin from Google said this about reporting quarterly earnings. They're not going to do it. They said, focusing on quarterly earnings is like going on a diet, getting on the scale every 5 minutes. If you're into long-term strategy, if you're into planting a tree for which the shade you won't get to enjoy it, if your strategy is part of a long-term, getting those quarterly earnings is not going to work. But how many organizations are focused on those quarterly earnings? They subordinate the mission. You see it all the time. Enron, WorldCom. You see it all the time where people are subordinating the mission in order to get short-term earnings. Don't do that. Well, yeah, I don't think you should. Here's another one of those things you got to do in strategic planning. Make sure everybody understands. And again, you can change these definitions any way you want to, but here are definitions that I like. The distinction between vision and mission. Mission's why we exist, what our customers pay us for, what funds our products or services. It's what we do. The vision is kind of what you want to be when we grow up, John F. Kennedy or Martin Luther King in 1963, who said, I have a dream where someday my children will be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. I have a dream. I love that speech. But the idea is that it's a long-term vision. It's a long-term idea of what can you be. What's the best you could be if there are no constraints that were holding you back? I like this one. I think this is a mission, but I like that, and I think you should think about how to build this into your organization. The mission of the American Red Cross is to improve the quality of human life, to enhance self-reliance, concern for others, and to help people avoid, prepare for, and cope with emergencies. So if you work for the American Red Cross, if you're a stakeholder in the American Red Cross, does this help you understand the decision-making process? You understand the mission, and you're not going to subordinate this mission for short-term value, are you? Yeah. Now, I want you to cross 5 words or phrases off each one of your 2 lists. This is called focus. Now, if you've only got 4, it's called focus. Cross off half of what you got on both of your lists. Do you think I'm a pain in the ass? Yes! In case you haven't figured this out, in about 5 more minutes, maybe 5 more minutes, I'm going to ask you to write a vision or a mission statement, depending on how you phrase it. But it could be either one. It could be what you do or what you want to do. It could be either one. But
just thinking about
this point, I'm a little
break here. Is a vision statement, I'm just going to ask one of my buddies, maybe I'll just go stupid, but is a vision statement a mission statement? Where is your mission statement? You're launching
a
plan to your vision statement.
Yes.
I have a mission statement.
A mission or a vision?
A mission.
Yeah, good. I think it could come either way. I actually do. I think it's a great question. So which comes first, the cart or the horse? I don't know that it really matters as long as you're clear. And I think a mission statement could be a launching point for a vision statement. And I think vision statements have to keep changing. I think mission statements do too. Here's what I really believe. I really believe that you got to have them.
Okay. So, you say you think mission statements have to keep changing.
Well,
but does Starbucks mission statement that's on their cart, that's a mission statement, does it change?
It has. It has changed. It's changing, it's in the process of changing right now. Howard Schultz said he'd never sell sandwiches. They're selling sandwiches now, aren't they? The idea of being the finest coffee purveyor they're selling some of the finest music in the world. They just signed Paul McCartney as they're going to exclusively distribute his music. What's that have to do with coffee?
It's the culture.
It's the culture. That's the right answer. But they have changed and it's morphing. Yeah. Now I would say to you, there are some organizations whose mission never changes. Religious organizations and things like that. Vision and mission probably never change. There are some organizations that have to change more frequently. I think if you're in a high-tech industry or you're part of a technology, it probably has to change more often. But I think it's a great question, Wendy. I think, but again, here's what I really believe. If you take the time to think these things out, if you take the time to write them down, if you take the time to share them inside your organization, you're going to be ahead of your competition. Don't get hung up. I don't think you should get hung up on which one comes first and if you did them wrong or sequentially backwards. Even though I think you did them sequentially, but no. I'm going to cover a couple more things here, then I'm going to ask you to write your own little vision statement here in a couple of minutes, and I'm going to give you just a couple more ideas. So this is my buddy Peter Drucker. He says you should always ask yourself these questions. Who is the customer? Now that seems like the customers are people who own the dog, own the cat. But think a little bit deeper on this question. Who really is your customer? If you could think of the customer who loves you best, who really believes in you, back to the first 10 things I ask you, who really thinks that you're special in some way. Who are those customers? Think about that now from a segmentation point of view. I know you probably haven't all taken marketing classes, but segmentation is this. And we live in an idea that's called mass customerization. Probably haven't heard that term, but from a marketing point of view, it means this. You believe in yourself, you're a segment of one, you want special treatment. I want everything customized to me. I want to go online and I want to get my pants customized to me. I want nobody else to have the exact, that's by the way, obviously not true of me. But my wife, she wants a pair of blue jeans that fits her perfectly. And by the way, they do. Perfect, I love it. But everybody wants it exactly their way. They want their car customized. Dell, mass customization. Dell Computer just figured out, I call up, I go online, I get the gig of RAM and the gig of this and the gig of that, and I get it exactly my way, and there are always trade-offs, but it's mass customized. Mass, big organization, customized, segment one. Starbucks, there's about 20 different drinks, 25 different drinks these days on the Starbucks menu. How many different ways can you order a Starbucks beverage at the local Starbucks? 67,000 was the latest algorithm, or latest one in the algorithm. But it's half calf, decaf, one pump of soy, one pump of, you know, whatever. There are 67, the average Starbucks has 67,000 different ways to order beverages. Mass, how can you use this? So when you think about this, who is your customer? Who is your customer? How can you segment to that segment of one? How can you make that one customer just feel great so they have a story and they feel empathy and they love your design? Yeah. What's our mission? We talked about that. Why does our organization exist? Why do you exist? And again, there's a surface answer to this. We don't want the surface answer. We want the deep answer. What's the really deep answer? Why does your organization exist, where it exists, where it sits in the marketplace? Why does it exist in the way that you've designed it? What's your strategic plan for why your organization exists? Yeah. So, I love this one. I'm going to give you a couple of vision statements so you'll... Creativity loves constraints. We help people trade practically anything on earth. They had to insert that word because there was some stuff getting traded on eBay they didn't like. We won't go down that path. We will continue to enhance the online trading experiences of all collectors, dealers, small businesses, unique item seekers. Unique item seekers, yeah. Interesting stuff on eBay. Bargain hunters, opportunity sellers, and browsers. They've understood their customer. They've gone pretty deep into what their customer and what the segmentation. Are they doing okay? Is this an innovative company? Yeah, they've done all right. So we start with the right goal, the vision. Now we're going to enable the company to deliver a differentiated value proposition. What's your value proposition? Do you have a value proposition? Do you know what I mean by value proposition? What's the word value mean? What's the word value mean? What's that?
Something of worth.
Excellent answer. Something of worth. Here, I'm going to get to something here. Come on. Yeah. What is value? Here's my definition. It comes from a variety of different sources. Value equals benefit minus cost. This is part of the value proposition. You heard that term. What's your value prop, right? Key to understanding that is what's your value proposition is what benefit is greater than the cost people pay for. True of relationships, true of businesses, true of lots of different things. True of leadership, I think. Let me illustrate this. If I'm an employee of your organization and my benefit is less than the cost that you're providing, less than the cost that you're paying me, there is less than value. It's negative value, right? If your customer walks into you and you charge them $500, but you save their dog, you save their cat, they feel like the benefit was much better than the $500, don't they? I would. I have. I've done this. It's embarrassing how much we spend with our pets these days. That's not embarrassing for you. It's embarrassing for some of us. But I have felt great value from my veterinarian clinics when they provided benefit that was greater than the cost. It's not always perfect world, but if you build up those relationships and meaning and story and symphony, if you build up those relationships from a strategic point of view, then even if you fail once or twice, they're going to forgive you because over the long term you provided benefits. Is that also true of relationships? Yeah. I teach leadership too, but here's sort of a segue off. From a leadership point of view, if you're providing benefit to your employees greater than the cost of doing business with you, is that reverse in a way? Yeah, it is. But if you're providing benefit, if you're providing leadership, if you're providing empowerment, if you're making them feel better about themselves for working with you, then you're providing value to them where the benefit is greater than the cost. You ever been in a relationship? Yeah, back with the Yellowtail Wine story when I was 24 years old and had that first date, where I was providing a little less benefit to the relationship than the cost that I was charging to that relationship. Yeah, cost is not just money. Take the word money out of the idea of cost, because you got to provide value to your customers that has a lot more to do than just with the check or the credit card they give to you. The cost is how far do I have to drive? How convenient is it to do business with them? Do they make it difficult when I walk in the door? Do they remember my name? Is there an extra cost to doing business? I don't do business with Radio Shack anymore. You know why? The cost is greater than the benefit. I don't care how cheap their batteries are. They want to know my home phone number. I'm not giving to them, and I'm tired of them asking. Sorry. I don't want to bash Radio Shack. Yeah, I do. But the benefit doesn't outweigh the cost for me because I get tired of saying, no, I'm not giving you my home phone number. Do you provide value in your organization, and do you provide value to your customers? Yeah. The strategy should reflect a distinctive value chain. Every point in the value chain, every time you come in contact with a customer, do the people in your organization add value? Value, benefit greater than cost. All right, so we've got past that. So you always got to figure this trade-offs. We already talked about this, and here's the part I promised to get to that ought to be a part of your strategy. So these are the four frames for Blue Ocean Strategy. The first two are over here, create and raise. What are you going to create? Yeah, you can't read that. I'm going to give, I'll read them to you. Create. What factors should be created that the industry has never offered? Think about Yellowtail Wine. I'm going to illustrate this with Yellowtail Wine in a second. But what did they offer that the industry didn't offer? Ease of understanding. I could pronounce Chardonnay, couldn't pronounce Puy Fousse. It's got a great label. So they created this sort of irreverence in the wine industry. What is raised above the industry standards? Now, here's what they raised above the industry standard. They gave you a decent bottle of wine for a lower price. Now, here's the key to strategy in my mind, though. What can you reduce or eliminate? What factors can go well below the industry standards? What can you take below the industry standards that people think are important? There's a guy named Bert Rutan. Anybody know who Bert Rutan is? Built this thing called Spaceship One. He's the first civilian to get in space twice. Won the X Prize. He spent about $20 million, $30 million of Paul Allen's money, but he won $10 million. I guess that worked out okay for him. I'm not sure about Paul Allen. Paul is one of the founders of Microsoft. He can afford it. Bert Rutan said this in a speech I heard about a year ago. He said the thing that got Spaceship into One was not these two factors, because that had already been created. It was rocket science. It was already out there. The create and raise from a rocket science point of view was already out there. All they had to do was steal those ideas. It's okay to steal, by the way, and steal ideas, not steal medicine, things like that. But it's okay to steal ideas. So he just stole those ideas. But here's what got Spaceship One into space. He took the crap off, that's his term, took the stuff off of this little tiny spacecraft that people thought was necessary, but it wasn't. Extra computer systems, extra guidance system, things that weighed an ounce that was the difference between him getting Spaceship One into space successfully twice, because he could reduce and eliminate. Let me give you a different approach. So this is the yellowtail wine. This is called a strategic canvas. Strategic canvas is the idea of, here's how we measure ourselves against the rest of the industry. Here's what Yellowtail Wine did. Yellowtail Wine said, they said this, they said, you know what we realize? There's a certain snootiness to wine. Typically it's Old World, it's French, Italian, lots of these things like Mourvedre and Chasson Montrachet and things my wife can pronounce, but I'm probably screwing it up, but if you speak French, don't yell at me. Things that really aren't important to the typical wine drinker. They're important to the old wine drinker, people like me in the old restaurant business, but they really don't matter. We can get rid of them. So how many people really care about the use of onological terminology and distinctions in wine communication? How many of you really care about the wine? No. Okay, we're going to eliminate that one. How about all the marketing, all the billboards? Do you care about that? Do you want to pay for that? No, you don't want to pay for that either. Okay, good. How about aging quality? Do you really want to know the vintage? Does anybody really? There's a few. But what segment of the population understands vintage, the aging of wine? What? It's like 10% of the population. The hell with that. I want to go after the 90. So we can get rid of that. How about vineyard prestige? Legacy. Anybody want to pay extra because it comes from bone, from Côte de Rhône? Anybody want to pay? You want to pay extra for that? Apparently you don't care. So we're going to eliminate that crap too. We're going to take this all off. Yeah. So, complexity. Now we're starting to think maybe these are things that are important to today's wine drinkers, which, by the way, were yesterday's beer drinkers. So, different kinds of wines, wine range. But we want it to be easy drinking, easy to select, and what the hell? This is wine. It ought to be fun, adventurous. The key to Yellowtail Wine is they took away all of these things that were so, so, so bloody expensive. They took away all those things that were so bloody expensive in the wine, eliminate them, save money, so now I can get a decent bottle of Chardonnay. I can pronounce it. I like the label. It's got a cute little kangaroo on the cover. I understand it. Makes me feel friendly about it. The guy says, "Hey, mate," when I buy it. Let's throw some shrimp on the bar. I can't say it, but you know. It's fun. It's adventurous. Why not? They took all of the costs out of it that didn't matter to the beer drinker. Why not? Does anybody care about onophiles, pedophiles, or all this? No, not the same. Onophiles are wine drinkers. Yeah. So, now, it's time for you to write your vision. Can you write your vision? Two sentences. This is creativity, life's constraints. But I'd love to hear two sentences. And by the way, it could be a mission or a vision statement. But if you take the words that you're now down to five words or phrases about what customers love about you and five words or phrases about things that you love to do, and maybe bring those two things together, and maybe take some of these ideas about things to raise, eliminate, create, or whatever you want to do. But can you write a couple of sentences for a vision statement or a mission? We won't argue. Think about that sentence, maybe. This is what you're supposed to do, but what will your customers pay you more to do because you're the best at it? The premier purveyor of. What kind of a dog is that?
It's a Stray, last year's Stray model.
It's last year's Stray. What a great face. Oh, you've got a great face.
I know. She's tired. Not that you put her to sleep. Just
So she went up for a glass of Yellowtail?
Right.
No pressure. Not that I'm a college professor or anything, but anybody want to share? Anybody write something they think is brilliant? My mission statement when I came out of that retreat I told you about in Estes Park was, life is uncertain, eat dessert first. I trademarked that. I lost the trademark because I couldn't. There were too many other people using it, but this is 1987. I trademarked the phrase, life is uncertain, eat dessert first. That was a weird mission statement, wasn't it? But it was really appropriate for Port-au-Prince. We weren't rocket scientists. We didn't have to take life too seriously. Let's have some fun. And if our customers want to order chocolate cake before the Eggs Benedict, what do we care? Right? Life is uncertain. Eat dessert first. Bit of a weird mission statement. One of the managers of the Aspen Port-au-Prince did. Yeah. Life is uncertain, eat dessert first, yeah. I'm not sure where it came from. We trademarked it, so we owned it, but yeah, I don't know. So I have a couple last thoughts. Anybody want to share?
Well, now my husband had to come up with a different statement for a retreat we were at, and this was, work hard, play hard, and nap on Sundays.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, so
yeah.
I do have one, and it needs a lot of work and refinement, but to provide an extraordinary animal healthcare experience, emphasizing valuing the relationship with each client and patient. We're passionate about providing progressive, proactive, individualized care.
That's pretty cool.
There
are a lot of good words in there, and I think if your partners understand that, you'll probably go far. Well, it's time for me to wrap this up. I'm going to turn it over to Constance in just one second, but I want to leave you with one very philosophical statement here. Does everybody know what the Doppler effect? You know, we get to make up words. The Doppler effect, you know, yeah. Doppler effect is that thing Einstein said. You know, trains coming at you really fast. Yeah. Well, here's the Doppler effect. The propensity of stupid ideas to sound good because they come at you rapidly. Yeah, what do you think? We live in a world of speed and convenience. How can you take advantage of speed and convenience in the world in which you live? If I don't leave you with anything else, I want to leave you with this. There's a lot of research that goes into the idea that people who have an idea, who write it down, who follow the plan, are far more successful than the people who don't. There was a study done in the class of 1953, Yale 1953, and they followed these people for about 40 years after they graduated. The 3% of the class of 1953 from Yale that wrote down their goals, who created a personal strategy, and kind of kept in touch with it throughout their lives, their net worth, the 3%, their net worth was greater than the other 97%. How about your net worth? You want that to be up? Write some goals down. Get a personal as well as an organizational strategy. Keep it in mind and execute it on it whenever you can. I want to thank you very much. I've had more fun than you had, I promise. Constance.